Check.
Yep. We're recording. Check, 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 check. Booyakasha. We're on.
You could not sound less like Ali G than what you just did. I'm Matt.
I'm Richard.
And we talk about things in the entertainment industry that peak pike. What was it?
I think it's, I don't remember. Pike?
I haven't said it in so long. I usually say capture our interest.
One of those words.
I was trying to change it up, and you're eating while we're recording.
Sorry.
That's, nothing says professional like eating on mic.
I had no idea we were professional.
Well, we want to strive. That should be a goal to strive for.
This is true.
So, a mixed bag of things on the list this week to discuss in no particular order, as always. So last week I borrowed your Arrested Development Season 3 DVD.
Yeah.
And
You'd seen them all, though, right?
I'd seen most of them.
Yep, yep.
Like the end of the Charlize Theron arc I missed.
Honest to God, that was a pretty funny little arc. They were making fun of it on I was reading something where they're saying, oh, they're stretching, trying to get star power out of her, whatever. But the whole point where she ended up being retarded, it just was honestly really funny. And they kept referring back to it in little ways, and it was just very funny.
I mean, overall, I was reminded of how much I love that series, and it quite literally could have been, in my mind, the funniest comedy ever on TV. I mean, there's a lot of competition. There's Larry Sanders, there's The Simpsons, there's Futurama, which are all different types of, types of comedy, but in terms of like a sitcom-y comedy, this to me, it sets the bar.
Yeah,
it was
pretty incredible.
So well written, and really that's what it comes down to. I mean, it was well acted and well produced, but it's the writing that really sets this apart. And watching and the Charlize Theron arc, where it turns out at the end she's mentally retarded and you don't know until the end. And someone was interviewing her about that, and she's saying, well, it's interesting because they had to write it. They had to write the dialogue so that there could be three different interpretations.
Yeah.
The flat out on the surface interpretation.
She's a spy.
She's a secret agent interpretation. And then you go back and she's mentally retarded interpretation.
Exactly.
And
it plays. It was a little weird. Like you couldn't get what they're getting at, but it plays so well on so many levels, and you're exactly right. Going back and watching it, it's like designed to be watched multiple times.
And God, that the Save Our Bluths episode where they have this fundraiser, and there's so many levels. It's very meta, where they're talking about, maybe if the family was more relatable. I hear that's an issue we have.
Oh, yeah.
Which, I remember the first...
That was clearly when they were fighting for their own existence.
Yeah, and the first time I saw that, I think I fell off the couch, because that's the big complaint my wife had. She thought it was funny, but it was hard to watch because none of the characters were likable. And so to hear them address that up front, I thought it was hysterical. And talking about, the Home Builder's Office is out, HBO is out, it's going to be Showtime. And, the bit where put your 3D glasses on now, and for no reason there's a tomato thrown at the screen, and then Andy Richter playing five parts.
Oh, that was brilliant.
And and then the little live scene at the end where it's like they threw every cliche of how to do a poor gag to get you to watch in one episode, and it was so funny.
Yeah, it was extremely well done. I've seen that where they do it before, where they start referencing the internal struggles of a show, and it's actually not that great. Here it was great on every level, because they clearly said, we're going to put a gag in here, but it better be funny. It's not just to make ourselves laugh. And each one of those you listed, they were all legitimately funny, even if it didn't occur to you that they were struggling for their life and they're trying to make fun of the conventions.
We've spent so much time fawning over this show, but just watching it again. And Costco's got a deal. You can basically get all three seasons for about $44 total.
Jeez.
And I thought about it, and I was like, oh, but both you and John both have them all. Yep. And then they're going to have that thing on MSN where you can watch them all.
I know. So I bought all of them because I really didn't watch them in regular
time. And there's
really
not that many, not that much in terms of extras going on. There's a few episodes with commentaries.
The commentaries are great. They're really great. It's cool to hear, like, for instance, David Cross in the context of being in a different, if I've heard him in other things where he is the top dog, he's like on Mr. Show and stuff. And it's interesting to hear him in the context of being kind of a partial player and and have like a different dynamic. But I've loved the commentaries. It's kind of funny to see some of the actors are really, they've loved being part of it, but they're not the hip smart people on the show.
I didn't
show
listen
and stuff.
To the third season ones because it, you know, it's only on a few episodes. I listened to the earlier season ones and I actually thought it doesn't work that well because it's too many people at once for too short a time.
It worked on the Mr. Show ones. They had like 10 people on those things. I love those commentaries.
I don't think they had 10. They had maybe 4 or 5.
Well, I loved them. I think they're great. You're right. When there is too many people, you need a ringleader a little bit.
You know, then it becomes they're all trying to make each other laugh instead of really kind of discussing the show. And to me, although they're great and funny people, it just ends up not being what I want it to be.
So, well, as a commentary fanatic, I definitely enjoyed it.
Okay, well,
but I totally hear what you're saying. I personally enjoyed these ones.
You sent me an email about your profound irritation with the way they were promoting.
Did you the Office? The new season of The Office started this week. Did you see any of that?
I saw a bit.
Did you see any? I mean, the previews.
Yeah.
Everyone I ever saw showed melancholy. There was nothing from The Office. It was just the two characters that are in love in the show, and it was all promoting their love affair and will they get together. And it wasn't even done in like an ironic sense, like if you're a real fan, we're making fun of the fact that this is kind of a dumb thing. That was the entire promotion on every level, with sappy, you know, string music and will they get together and it's a new era. And it was like ER, it was like the way they would promote all these other things. It was killing me. Of course, when I watched the show was fantastic and had nothing to do with that, but it was like destroying me that was how they were promoting the show.
And I guess in thinking back about it, you're right in that was pretty much the exclusive aspect.
I saw 3 different promotions and they were all focusing on that.
And I saw the promotions, but I didn't notice it for some reason. It didn't stick out in my head like it stuck out in yours. I don't know. Maybe they're figuring. Maybe they figure they're really not going to blah 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 blah.
Their core audience already gets it. Well, let's go for somebody who might want to.
Maybe because the fact that these two guys kiss at the end of the first season was something that they did not do in the British version.
Yeah.
So this is sort of quote unquote uncharted territory, even though they've really left behind the British plots and are into their own thing now. So, and everybody's saying, you know, so many shows rely on sexual tension, and once you resolve that one way or the other, it loses something.
Yeah, but to me, it's such a small aspect of this show that it doesn't really matter to me.
Well, a lot of people have latched onto that aspect, though, because Americans really like that.
I know, and it kills me, because like you're saying, it ruins shows. It's usually like the third season.
And so a lot of people are like, oh my God, what are they going to do? You know, the overwhelming reaction being, don't mess it up. Whatever you do, don't mess it up. And so I kind of think that the advertising was geared towards that. Yeah. Hey, Office fans, we've been gone for the summer. Don't forget how we left it. Don't forget that you really, really, really want to know what happens.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the tack they were taking and kind of ignoring new people.
Yeah.
Maybe figuring that the fact that it won Best Comedy Emmy would bring in new people on its own. I don't know.
Needless to say,
you're right. It's interesting that they chose to emphasize the non-comic aspects of a comedy.
Needless to say, though, the show was really funny.
Oh, my.
It was really good.
And I haven't seen all the American ones. That was the most awkward, most difficult to watch American Office I've just entirely because of the conference room scene. Yep. When Michael is trying to deal with the outed coworker, and he's trying to kiss him, and it was so hard to watch.
It was funny.
Hysterically funny.
Oh, and what's his name, the character, when he went off to the other, he's at the other Dunder Mifflin place, and he's trying his little things, and they're not going over the same way. when he puts his stapler or whatever in Jell-O at the calculator, and then he starts to realize the guy's legitimately really mad.
Yeah.
And then the one time, there was one scene in there, not to go over it though, when they're interviewing his coworkers and they go, he's always looking at the camera and giving this look.
And then she completely, perfectly apes it.
It was perfect.
It really was.
So I was so excited. It's like, wow, I forget. There's really great comedy out there. I mean, you forget. But
well,
anyway,
there's a bit of a renaissance in terms of sitcoms actually being funny.
Oh, just
not that many of them, but the few that are out there, Earl, The Office,
Arrested Development,
canceled. Really funny.
Did you see that article I sent you about the international versions of The Office?
I saw the headline.
It was a really good article because they're pointing out that Gervais must be making a fortune off this if they've done this right, because they also sold The Office to Germany and France. So what this person did was, this person writing the article visited and watched the different shows, which are all on the surface extremely similar, but they were exploring the differences. So the person was saying, well, of course, one of the things the writer did was look to see exactly how much work was actually getting done in these offices. And they pointed out in the American office, kind of work actually gets done, not much, but work in the British office, the whole point is avoiding work. And in Germany, everybody's industrious. And they did the different bosses and how they're different, but not totally different. I just thought it was a fascinating exercise. The whole point to office can be expanded kind of across the globe. But what they did originally, when they sent the British office to Germany, they dubbed it and it was a huge flop. So what they ended up doing was exporting the actual thing, and they still have the characters, the two that are in love, the other thing. But I don't know. I just thought it was interesting to show how the Office idea is totally exportable, but it has to be, you know, to be localized, like Microsoft localizes XP. You know,
it seems to me, though, that part of the success of British and American is the awkward humor, because awkward humor is so, it's very British. That is a British staple. A staple of British comedy is the awkwardness to it.
Well, and both of the French and German, they also have the same awkward
but
humor.
But it seems to me, I mean, I don't know French and German comedy styles at all, but it doesn't seem to me that it would play the same over there. Like, they would need to change it in some fundamental way, so it's not about the awkwardness, it's about some other aspect of it.
Boy, at least reading this article, I haven't seen it. I'd like to, because I could probably, I don't know, I know
but
little German and
saying.
French, but yeah, but they were saying that, no, they did transport
then that's,
but I don't know, I just thought it was really interesting that the main differences they said was the subtle differences of the characters. None of the David Brent character, none of them, including Steve Carell, smartly, none of them exactly mimic him. Their unique character that's equally kind of clueless about how they come across, but unique in a different way. Anyway, I just thought it was kind of cool to see that. I was thinking that I wonder how much Gervais, if him and Stephen Merchant own the rights to it, if they own part of it, or how much they get out of that, because it clearly they've created a global brand, which is pretty incredible. Anyway.
Yeah, that was, it's just funny seeing the relatable aspects to your own workplace.
Yeah.
Especially the diversity training and having to sit through diversity training.
Yep.
All right. Next on the list, in no particular order, you sent along the article about the PS3 pricing.
Yeah.
And it's,
what did it say again? It said it was like a new
Well, basically the Japanese PS3 will be the base version will be sold for the equivalent of $410. Which is a price drop, but because you sent that to me and I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I went around all the gaming sites I know of.
Yep.
And apparently that is specific to the Japanese market. So it's not.
Do you make of that? Why is it because they're worried that they need to make a huge push in Japan?
Because you think the one market they know it's going to be successful is Japan.
Yeah, that was my take.
So
on
maybe it does augur a price drop, but I honestly don't see that coming for the initial launch, because Sony seems very proud and very stubborn, and for them to drop the American price now would essentially be admitting a mistake and saying, we were completely wrong, and everyone yelling at us. You know,
that's right.
Penny Arcade in the gaming world famously saying that the pricing of the PS3 is grade A BS, and they are not going to buy one at launch because of the price is so high.
Yeah, it is. It's ridiculous too.
And so it's hard to, maybe this means that they will lower the price faster than they intended to.
Yeah.
like in the spring of 2007, but I don't know. It's just so, and clearly any price lowering they do just increases their losses.
Yeah. You did. Have you been following the whole HD drive thing for the Xbox thing?
A bit. I find it very weird because what happened was that they basically displayed the HD DVD drive in Japan at the Tokyo Game Show.
Yep.
And sort of announced that it would support 1080p, kind of, sorta. There's a lot of fine print revolving around the way it supports 1080p. Yeah,
one was saying that it would use an output port of a VGA output port.
Yeah, basically you need a VGA cable in order to do it.
Yeah, which is interesting because a VGA cable, that the point to that is that you can get away without having DRM through it, pardon me. So you're just pumping it straight to your system without having the HDMI port, which can incorporate DRM. And it's almost like they did that because they realized there's so many issues with their own DRM schemes that, pardon me, that they just wanted to give somebody an ability to pump out 1080p without having any problems. I don't know. It's hard for me to figure out what's going on with that decision. If you have a video projector, it's great because all video projectors have VGA ports, so it's like perfect. And some of them don't even have HDMI ports yet, but for widescreen TVs, there's dongles you can get so you can convert it to component, but I don't know, it just seems weird. But the more I look at it, the more I'm assuming that I'm going, if I get a gaming console, definitely be an Xbox 360 and definitely HD. I would do it just because it'd be fun to watch high-def movies.
And the other aspect was that the HD DVD drive, equivalent pricing to $170.
Which is stunning.
Because most people are guessing $200 to $250.
Yeah.
$250 puts it a little out of the easy purchase range for me. Yep. $200 is closer to the, I'll get that.
Yep.
But if it's closer to $170...
That's a pretty good price.
And I've got friends at work at Microsoft.
I mean, that's
so
half of an iPod.
I can probably get it through the MS store for less. And, oh, man.
It's like half the price of an iPod. That's a pretty good deal.
Which is, we were talking about the Zune and the iPod last week a lot.
Yeah.
One thing we completely overlooked, and I didn't think of it until I saw the commentary along these lines. When MS announced the Zune, they didn't announce the pricing. And a lot of people are saying they were surprised by Apple lowering the price of the iPod.
Yep.
And so suddenly Microsoft is reevaluating, saying, whoops, we can't sell it for what we were going to sell it for because it's would either be more than the iPod or probably more than it was probably $299.
Yep.
And then they dropped it to $249?
Well, it depends on which iPod you're talking about. But $249 is the base one now, the base video iPod.
That was an... If that's why Apple did it, what a great strategic move.
I know, I love
Apple.
What
a great little poke in the eye to their...
Apple's just sitting in the catbird seat with all of their... They've got things down the channel, and they could kind of... It seems like, not always, but a lot of times, they can hit go when they want to, and they can do it in anticipation and kind of ruin the days of a lot of other developers and other companies. And I got the distinct impression in this case, it was the same thing. And they're so dominant in the MP3 player world that they can kind of dictate those prices. And I assume they're making an enormous profit on these. I assume early on, a lot of times they sell them at a loss, but towards the end of the thing, you got to assume they're making an enormous profit on the iPods.
Although I saw a few screenshots of Tokyo about some of the PS3 games, and they are gorgeous looking shots.
Yeah.
So I would get a PS3 because I don't play enough video games for it to even be a consideration.
Yeah.
I don't get enough use. I don't play enough games on the 360 I have. I'm certainly not paying for a PS3.
Speaking of games, one thing we forgot to talk about last week was when Apple, did their actually a pretty comprehensive, enormous announcement stuff. They added games to the iPod, and I immediately downloaded or paid for Bejeweled and Texas Hold'em. Uh-huh. And it's stunning how good they work and how addicted I've become to poker. Somebody who's never played poker in my entire life. And I realize playing it, how I get pretty good at it. But I would be the absolute worst real-life poker player. The worst on every level. Because I'm so, like, well, screw it. I'm all in on this thing. I would on every time I would be making the wrong decisions. I would be what's known as like fresh fish to any even reasonably competent poker player.
So you'd be like Michael Scott in Casino Night, yeah, all in on the first hand, and he gets beat by Toby. It's like, you're not supposed to do that. I'm all in. I'm okay, Michael. Thanks.
That's basically me, but it's still a lot of fun. But honestly, the games look really, really good. I wonder if it's like an open system and they're letting other people develop them, because they don't look like they're that tough to develop, but they look really good. But they only have the 10 games. None have been added. I haven't heard anything new. But anyway, so I love using the iPod as a game player. The one downside to it is, wow, does it ever suck the power running those games? It must be like the equivalent of showing video or more, because it will just suck the power straight out. In fact, if you can like leave the, if you're somehow having it plugged into a power source, that's the best way to operate them. But anyway.
Yeah, if I took the bus or took the train or flew a lot, that might be more of a consideration. But when I'm using my iPod, I'm listening to it. I'm never really interacting with it. I don't have that time.
Yeah.
I mean, and usually if it's something to do while you're sitting on the couch watching TV, I usually have my laptop. So that's, yeah, I'm fidgeting that way. If I didn't have a laptop, that might be a good TV fidget thing.
Yeah.
Cause I it's very hard for me to sit and just watch a TV show and do nothing else.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I hear you. I tend to do three things at the same, or I tend to think I do three things at the same time. I'm actually doing one at a time with all things going on. But anyway,
so sent you a link to the 300 trailer.
Yeah.
And this is a movie adaptation of a graphic novel by Frank Miller, who is
the famous great graphic novel artist.
Well, he is the creator of Sin City. Mm-hmm. He did Batman Dark Knight Returns, and then he did this other graphic novel called 300, which is about 300 Spartans holding off the Persian army.
Like 30,000.
Yeah, thousands and thousands, yep, and thousands through this geographic...
like a pass. They're completely surrounded, and it's like a little...
Right, yeah. But it forced the Persian army to bottleneck, and that's how these 300 could hold them off. But,
yep.
And so the trailer is very, it indicates a very stylized movie, because they shot a lot of this green screen.
I heard it was like pretty much all green screen. The surprising thing for me with the trailer, for some reason I had it in my head it was going to be like Sin City. I don't know why I had it in my head.
What aspect?
In the aspect of almost looking... almost looking like a black and white pen and ink look.
Oh, well, but the 300 graphic novel was full color.
Yeah, so see, really, I didn't realize that.
Which I have read and own. And yeah. So the trailer actually does represent, I mean, basically it's doing the same thing Sin City did, in that it treats the graphic novel as storyboards for the movie.
Yeah.
Because there were clearly a lot of scenes pulled directly from panels in that graphic novel. It looks a little over the top, like they're playing it a little extreme, which is fine as long as it, you know, it's hard to tell from the trailer, but I have no problem with that as long as it works internally.
See, I look at it and it looked beautiful, but like I was telling you in my email, to some extent, it just had this, and I think it was because of the acting, it had this faint whiff of like Aeon Flux or something about it.
Yeah,
meaning it was just a little like, uh-oh, I've seen really beautiful things before that don't pay off in terms of a movie. But that said, you know, I loved Sin City. I thought it was really a unique vision. I don't know how much that was Frank Miller and how much that was Robert Rodriguez. But anyway, some of the acting in this, I went online to look and see if I could, because I didn't recognize any of the actors, and I went and looked online and it didn't help. I still didn't know who they were.
Yeah, they're all unknown.
So it seemed a little over the top, but that said, some of the imagery in there was legitimately beautiful, and it's a really cool story. So if he does a good job of making it involving, I mean, Frank Miller clearly knows how to tell a story in an evolving way. So I definitely am looking forward to it, but it's I don't know. There's just a little whiff of it to me that sort of put up a few alarm bells.
You had sent along something about the new Apocalypto trailer, which I have not seen.
Oh yeah. It's a good trailer, dude. It's like, and I mentioned in there, I'm going, God dang it. Why does Mel Gibson have to ruin my enjoyment of a movie by being such Jew-hating bastard, which I'm assuming he is. I mean, because it looked really good.
Just made me think of something.
And reading, I don't know if you read that, but he's been doing some test screenings floating around, and he did one for Harry Knowles on Ain't It Cool News, and did it in front of his festival. And I don't know if there was some deal going on, but Knowles and nobody mentioned even remotely any of Gibson's troubles. He just talked about the movie. And the way he's talking about the movie, I'm going, God dang, this is exactly the movie I want to see. And I'm kind of torn. Am I just going to go, you know, he's a jerk and I admit it, but I'm going to, that's a different thing. But the way he described the movie, it just sounds fantastic. It sounds like a movie that I would want to be totally all over. What surprised me was that the movie apparently is not done. Apparently the entire film score is temp track. Apparently they're still going to cut out some scenes and other stuff. And I'm surprised because he's on a tour right now. He's shown this to like five or six different places in the Southwest to some Indian groups and some other things. And I was actually kind of stunned that it's not done. And I was also surprised when I sent that to you that they actually, it does have a date. It's like in December. They're definitely pumping this out there, getting it out. That's no longer like, oh, is it going to come out or not? Apparently they just decided.
Honestly, my biggest problem with this movie is the fact that the Mayans, not all of them, but a lot of them, have bizarre, like, twigs through their nose.
Yeah.
Stuff like that, like, you know, ritual body piercings, which just creep me out completely.
Yeah. I'll tell you, looking at the video, you're watching this, you're going, the one thing that it's so weird about the Mayans, so much about what we think about old culture and old times is based around Western European culture, even of that time, like 1,000 years ago and 500 years ago. And the Mayan culture and the South and Central American culture was like created completely in a vacuum, so different from our culture that you look at. And it's Gibson seemed to have captured that really well. I was looking at that and going, wow, this is uniquely foreign, but apparently it's got a lot of the touches you'd expect. Apparently he made it extremely exciting, a lot of tension. It's not, I mean, it's all in a foreign language that nobody even knows what it is, but he still delivers the goods. I mean, Harry Knowles said it was an incredibly exciting, tense movie. And I don't know. I just don't know. I bought The Passion two years ago because it was like, you know, $7 at Blockbuster, just because I figured, well, I might as well see this thing. I still haven't gotten around to seeing the dang thing, but I loved Braveheart, you know. I don't know. I just don't know.
I've been meaning to talk about this for the past couple of weeks. The advertising campaign for Open Season is pretty extensive. I seem to be seeing commercials on all the shows I watch.
Yeah.
And this is, and then amusingly, there was a quote that Jeffrey Wells had on Hollywood Elsewhere last week. Some director basically saying, if I see another bus ad for another gosh darn animated movie about gosh darn animals. Oh, whoops. Can you bleep that out?
I'll do my best. Let's see. That's it. That's at 2740. Remind me of that number.
Try not to swear on this. I will frigging flip. And I completely agree. But you look at this thing. There's nothing going on. It's Martin Short. Not Martin Short. Martin Lawrence.
Yeah.
As his bear. And he's got wacky friends. But what kills me is, as they're trying to sell you the fact that there are big actor names in it, like Martin Lawrence, the second billed name, Ashton Kutcher.
Yay.
Am I supposed to get excited that Ashton Kutcher is, God, he's like a...
The B-list.
Well, I'm trying to remember what animal he's playing, but something with like one horn, like an antler or a...
A unicorn?
Oh, antelope, or I don't know, whatever it is, he's only got one antler on his head instead of two, and it's cute.
Because that's
wacky. And then the second level of named actors, Deborah Messing and someone else.
Wow, they're really going for the gusto of these.
What the? Talk about the least compelling anything. Just who cares?
It's hard to remember. There was a golden age about 4 years ago when there was maybe three or four of these digitally animated things a year, and they were like events, and oh, you had the DreamWorks people coming in with theirs, and they're you know, going against the Pixar people. And now if you add it up in terms of getting a wide release, there's probably like 25 a year of these animated movies that we just forget about them. even right now, like we forget about Monster House, and there's that open season, there's the Barnyard, there's I can't even remember half of them because I'm not even aware of them, but I look in the list, I go, what is that movie? And I go, oh, that's right, that's was some, or yeah, there was one I was just looking at the other day and I was totally unaware of it, like hello, I can't remember the name of it, but anyway, there's an enormous amount of them, and the quality obviously is just really, really low and really uninvolving. And you can see how when Shrek came out, let's go for the big people. Let's get Eddie Murphy and Cameron Diaz and Mike Myers. And now it's like Deborah Messing and Ashton Kutcher.
Ashton Kutcher!
I know. It's really kind of, it just shows how Hollywood works, you know? You take a formula, you beat it to death. And then you realize it's not really a formula, it's talented people.
So The Departed is getting good buzz.
Yeah.
Not to use a really tired phrase, but it's getting really astounding buzz. God, I'm going to stop saying that now. and now I'm looking forward to it. I was kind of mezzo on it, mainly because I don't really like films about undercover whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why. There's some aspect of my personality that has a hard time with people basically lying as they're,
yeah,
you know, doing that with so much on the line. But
the Donnie Brasco kind of thing.
And especially when it's people like in this, you've got Matt Damon and Leonardo DiCaprio, both people I like and actors I like, both playing moles, undercover people.
Yep.
And it's just, you know, something bad's going to happen to someone you like, and it's uncomfortable on a really weird personal level.
Yep.
But it's the, you know, people are saying it's a Scorsese's best since Goodfellas.
And now, a little bit of that vibe in the trailer because they throw a lot of different musical cues in there. But still,
and now that the commercials I'm seeing are using music that isn't the Rolling Stones, I'm more interested in it.
Yeah. Well, it's funny looking at that. People have been giving Scorsese a knock for the past couple of years, saying he's been trying to make popular movies that are Oscar winners, and he's like been clearly going for that. And what's funny is people forget actually his last two movies were actually not bad.
I think that's from our perspective. It seems like, you know, and mainly I'm taking this from Wells, that he's presenting it as, you know, Gangs of New York, not very good. Aviator, what was he thinking there? And a very dismissive tone. So when you say his last few films have been good, I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, I
really
enjoyed both
Gangs
of them
in New York.
And he was like nominated for Best Director. It was a good movie. It had its flaws, and there was problems with it, but it was a great movie. And The Aviator was a pretty great movie too. Good acting, excellent movie. I don't know. It's weird. Certain directors get held on a certain standard, and then different times in their career, Scorsese had the same thing happen, and when, you know, he had this very unique beginning to his career, which is incredible. And then later, I remember distinctly when he came out with The Rainmaker, and The Rainmaker was a John Grisham movie, and it was really pretty good for what it was, for what
it
was worth.
I never saw The Rainmaker.
It was actually really,
I read the book. I know
it is full of stars and stuff, but for what it's worth, he did a great job at this movie. But people are sitting there going, they were saying, yeah, he did a great job, but it's slumming and it's like this and that. And I'm thinking, just evaluate the movie for what it's worth. If it's a good movie, it's a good movie. It may not be Apocalypse Now, but how many movies are Apocalypse Now?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny because that's, you know, if it's sort of a spec script, like you just sort of signed on to do a job like Spike Lee did with Inside Man.
Yep.
And it just turns out great.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing The Departed too. It's
October 6th, I believe, is the release.
It's funny. There's been people are knocking the publicity campaign for it. They have a poster, which I think is unique, which it says it's like big block letters, the, and then D-part-ED-.
Bizarre.
If you look through the letters, you can see either, depending on the poster, Leonardo DiCaprio, Jack Nicholson, or whatever. And I actually kind of like it. It adds this weird dissonant tone, and it's, I don't know, I like that poster. People are like putting it down. I don't know. I thought it was cool. Anyway,
All the King's Men has apparently died.
Wow. 12% on the tomato meter.
And a blurb I read yesterday, so it wouldn't have included yesterday's numbers, 3.7 million.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that was just Friday or tracking in for the whole weekend or what, but just a complete and utter failure, which is, it's surprising because it seems like there'd be enough people you know, who would want to see it just on the fact that it's Sean Penn or Jude
Law.
Yeah,
but he's never, none of the people in the movie have ever shown any ability to open a movie, really.
I guess that's true, but, well, and then more telling was the fact that the big commercial going around last couple weeks, the pull quotes, a magnificent cast, a beautiful movie, like three or four gigantic slobbering pull quotes.
Yep.
Do you remember who they were from?
Jeffrey Lyons?
Larry King.
Larry King. Oh, man.
They were all from Larry King.
And what you're describing, by the way, even them are not actually good quotes. A magnificent cast.
Well, no, they were all, you know, a magnificent movie, a beautiful story. They were all slobbering. This Larry King, and I think most people, you know, the non-dorks, look at a commercial and they recognize when Larry King is the attributed quoter, they couldn't get anyone
a single other quote. Yeah, it did 12% on the tomato meter, and I don't know, you feel bad because this movie has been sort of troubled, but they've done a good job of sort of keeping that under wraps, basically saying, yeah, no, we were, because it literally, it was finished like a year ago. And apparently they've been trying to tweak it, work on it. And they were going to release it during the Oscar season last season and said, no, it's a great movie. No, we're going to do some stuff and change it. And that's the buzz they've been getting out. No, there's some problems with it, but we're going to fix it. Mm-hmm. Well, apparently, no, there was major problems. And they're just finally I mean, they're doing the best they can. They're polishing a turd, as they basically point out. I had no interest in seeing it whatsoever, but I always remember that when I think of this movie, I think of, this is the movie that when they were having the Oscars like a couple of years ago, and who was it that made fun of Jude Law for being in a bunch of movies? Who was the host? And then Sean Penn gets all uppity and upset and feels compelled to defend Jude Law, right, like he was even being put down because he had just filmed a movie and how, you know, brilliant Jude Law was, and this is the movie. And you end up realizing, I mean, so that's when I think of this movie, I think of, you know, a sanctimonious Sean Penn, who's one of my favorite actors. I love the guy, but on a personal level, the guy has zero sense of humor and he's very sanctimonious. So anyway, that's a movie I have no interest. It's the rare movie I probably would not even, I would turn off based on the buzz, not pick it up on DVD, and certainly not watch it on TV because it just sounds terrible. And it's not a subject that hugely interests me. I did like the first, All the King's Men. I saw it like 20 years ago, and I can't remember the guy, Broderick Crawford or somebody who played the guy. He was really good, but
so that's like coming in. Well, not last, but certainly of the new releases, last this weekend, number one this weekend,
Jackass number two.
All right. You didn't need to be quite that excited about it.
Cause I'm so want to see it. I can imagine where you come on the, want to see Pike. You're probably you and our buddy Mark.
I don't want to see it, but I'm not as scornful as I am about your addiction to wrestling.
They do have a, I think I watched wrestling like 5 times in the last year, but I do enjoy it. But they do have a, it did score fresh, barely, but it did score positive on the tomato meter.
It is what it is. It's these guys going around. It's essentially guys going around doing stunts, right? Doing bizarre, really
dumb,
bad
dumb
idea
things.
Stunts.
Exactly.
And that's fine, because that's not trying to be anything it's not. It's, you know what? We're doing dumb stuff. It's funny to watch. I get that.
They're basically the modern equivalent of the Three Stooges, which is doing stupid shit. Although on a real life version of it, they're basically doing stupid stuff that people wouldn't like. And you're hearing, I saw Johnny Knoxville being interviewed. He's talking about the inspiration of some of these stunts, like one where he is standing out in the middle of a field with a mask on, with a blindfold on and a cigarette, and a bull comes and knocks him over. He says, yeah, my buddy and I were watching a Tom and Jerry cartoon and all of a sudden a bull comes out and he puts on a little mask. And I thought, well, that'd be funny. And somebody had to point out, yeah, that's a cartoon. They're getting their inspiration from cartoons, but you're right. It's exactly what it is. There was a time in my life when I would go, oh, this is so stupid. People laugh at that. And now I've just kind of gone, you know, if I laugh, I'm not going to, I personally am not going to ever again, I've decided to feel bad that I laugh at something. If something makes me laugh, I'm not going to sit there. I'll recognize for what it is. Mm-hmm. And I'll recognize there's a more deep, true laugh in something in The Office. But if something viscerally makes me laugh, I'm going to laugh. And I'm not going to sit here and be dismissive about it. But, and I've had a long conversation, not long, but certain conversations with our mutual friend, Mark, who absolutely has no interest and just, it's like sickened by it. And he goes, oh, and if I laugh, I imagine I might say if I laugh, but I'll probably have, like, feel dirty afterwards. I'm going, you know, I don't want to have that attitude. I'm going to laugh because these guys are so stupid. But anyway, I definitely like it, or I'm interested in seeing it. I'll probably, if I do see it, want to see it in the theater, because it's one of those things like Borat where probably it's going to be funnier if you're seeing it with a lot of people. But anyway.
So did you have a chance to see Studio 60 on the Sunset
Strip? Yeah, I liked it.
I quite liked it too. And it's interesting because if you go back and you look at pilots after a show is two or three seasons in, and you look at the pilot and you realize how awkward it was, or how they just didn't have the vibe yet, or the rhythm's down, and it's just hard to watch. And for me, that's the case with the West Wing pilot too, because they didn't have the rhythms down. They were trying too hard.
Yep,
like Leo just wasn't Leo yet.
Yep,
and like there,
the there Simpsons, was, you know, a lot of these things. They were. And at the time, we thought, this is the greatest thing ever. King of the Hill, another one that seemed really... No, those are animated. But then you sit down later and you're going, wow, it's funny how much I love that, because it's funny how much better it is now.
Right. And so that being said, I felt like this was a pretty good show. There were aspects of it which didn't really click with me. And then I read the Salon TV critic, Heather Havrileski.
Yep.
She's great.
She's really good.
I love her writing.
Yep.
She had a comment that basically was saying the characters are too self-important for what they do. You can get away with it when you're on the West Wing, because it's the White House and you're governing and you're allowed to be important. Or if doctors in ER, you're saving lives, you're allowed to feel that way. When you're on a TV show, it's...
The stakes are pretty small.
Well, it's and I watched it again this morning because I was taping it for a friend. The first time I've actually used a VHS tape in probably a year.
Yeah.
And from that perspective, you know, there's a point where Josh, Bradley Whitford's character Danny says, you know, call down for my car. And they're just like, am I supposed to relate to this pompous jackass that makes millions of dollars and care about the fact that he failed a cocaine test? And so there's a bit of a disconnect that I did feel, but was, you know,
my suspicion is they'll work it all out.
And they probably will, because Aaron Sorkin's a great writer.
And one of the keys was he had so many of his like stock company that it's sort of like Joe Mantegna and William H. Macy in a David Mamet production. They know how to speak David Mamet. Well, so many of these people like Matthew Perry and Bradley Whitford and others in this thing, they knew how to do it. And I was like stunned at like, wow, I actually kind of like Amanda Peet in a role for once.
Although she's too young for that role. She is too young to be a...
She probably is, but I didn't have a viscerally negative reaction
I
do in so many other things she's been in.
And she's certainly pleasing to look at.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I would just look at this going, yeah, there's little issues. I mean, and what was weird was it was hard for me to put a finger on some of the issues. What the Heather Havrileski said was like, now you're saying, I'm going, yeah, that's exactly right.
She also meant, you know, the move towards the end where the camera's circling the two characters.
Yeah, it was all a
little too aggrandizing of the situation.
But overall, it was that's a pretty good.
Very good. I know, liking the interaction of Steven Weber as the evil studio boss. And anyway, it looks to be, and the interaction between Matthew Perry and Bradley Whitford works very well.
I liked about it too, was that they have Bradley Whitford, Matthew Perry, now who knows how it'll play out, but they're clearly a team. And it reminded me of Sports Night and how much I love Sports Night. And you had two characters that were not necessarily in competition with each other. They were each in their own way, the leads.
Yeah.
And I miss that. And I really like that. I love that aspect of Sports
Night. And as someone who I've been watching Sports Night again with my wife, cause she'd never seen it. And we're about done with it now. And you know, I miss the show a lot, but there are beats to it, which play out a lot more falsely than either West Wing or hopefully
in retrospect.
This show. And there are other, you know, you watch a lot of Aaron Sorkin and you certainly pick up on a lot of recurring themes he does,
yeah.
and even devices he's used in multiple shows. Like he used the same writing a letter to a family member in Sports Night and West Wing. And he used the same, my father's having an affair with a woman for 23 years and I just found out about it. He used the exact same plot device of what I just said in Sports Night and West Wing. So how long before it pops up?
It must be tough, you know, because there's only so much you can do. He's such a good writer.
It was fine within the context of each, but it kind of sticks out when you watch both shows.
Yeah. Anyway. I thought it was a good looking show, too.
That was the other thing. It looked like a really expensive pilot because of all the sets.
Yep.
And I remember reading something about an article about Star Trek a while ago. I think it was about The Next Generation. The writers decided to include a scene in the engine room because otherwise they wouldn't be able to afford to build an engine room set for X number of weeks or years.
Yep.
And if they got all the sets built for the first time, they were already built. They didn't have to worry about it.
Wow.
And I thought, that's interesting. I wonder if that type of gamesmanship is still a problem.
Yeah.
Although with Sorkin, when, you know, going into this bidding war for this show, you have to wonder how he's probably got a blank check for a certain amount of time of spending money on these incredibly expensive looking sets and all these different locations. And
well, but clearly they were giving him a full commitment. So they're saying, well, we're going to build in, we know this will be a success. We're going to give you a lot of money up front to get going on this.
That
thing.
Being said, I still hate the title.
Studio 60.
Oh my God. I hate Studio 60 on the, it sounds so pretentious. I hate anything with studio or sessions in the title. Sessions on West 64th or whatever. It's so pretentious to me.
Yeah, I hear you.
All right. So the other thing, I borrowed a number of DVDs from you last week.
Oh, yeah?
I borrowed the two Ali G season DVDs just so I could go back and watch all of the Borat sketches.
I find them,
and I finished
of
watching
all
those
the things, they're the most painful for me to watch.
Oh, my goodness. They are so painful. Yeah. Although, laughing so hard I was crying this morning when he goes into the country western bar and starts playing the song, Throw the Jews Down the Well.
Oh, so our country can be free.
And all these people are clapping along. Yeah, throw the Jews down the well.
They were like, who is this guy? And the minute he starts singing that, they got into it.
And it wasn't in an ironic, this is funny, intellectual kind of way. It's, no, we hate the Jews too.
It's so embarrassing to be American sometimes.
Oh, my God. But that was great. Anyway, and it's... God, talk about something I can never, ever do. I can play, you know, I can be funny. I can play a character. I can't make someone feel bad on purpose.
Yeah.
And God, they're doing the...
I know, that's the thing. Even the worst person in the world, I can't...
He's in the New Age dance troupe, and they're flopping around like a bunch of idiots. Ugh. And he says, you know, and the woman dancer, whose name was Palomino. Oh. He's like, how old do you think she is? And he's like, 48? No, she's 43. Oh, you look older. You look like much old.
God.
So awkward.
You know what's funny is I was watching on YouTube or what, I can't remember where I saw it, but they had some of his old BBC Borat episodes. And it's sort of like Aaron Sorkin Sports Night. It's like it totally wasn't it was funny, you know, him exploring Great Britain, you know, before people even knew Borat, but he didn't have his accent down. He didn't have the character down the way he did in America and clearly with the movie. So it's kind of it's interesting to see. It's not as funny and it's not as good. And they're not as extreme in Great Britain. They're not as awful and racist and everything else as parts of America are. So it's not as funny, therefore. It was just kind of interesting to see.
And so watching these, it was interesting thinking, how are they going to translate this to a 2-hour or hour and a half, more likely, movie without, you know, without it having being 90 minutes of squirming? You have to give the audience a break.
Yeah.
You have to let them breathe and not be uncomfortable for 90 minutes.
I wonder if they're doing anything
but
in this movie.
But if you look, the trailer works. I mean, the trailer feels like they altered it an appropriate amount, but trailers can lie, so...
Well, are they making like a narrative arc to this movie? Because they imply that it's going to be him going off. Yes. So it might be TV show and film or something.
I don't know if there's anything more than that. Like he's trying to save grandma's hovel or something.
I cannot be more excited about that movie.
It's going to, like, you know, my wife was reading a Newsweek last night and they've got this picture of him in that swimsuit. That is the best. That is the best costume I think I've ever seen. That one little, and it's such a simple idea. It's basically this G-string swimsuit that goes up from his crotch, splits in a V, and so it's one strap goes over each nipple and over the shoulder and back down the back, and it's a neon green. It's the most ridiculous, outlandish-looking thing, and so perfectly sums up the character.
His inability to recognize how inappropriate it is.
And, you know, he's a hairy guy.
I know.
He's not attractive. And it's just, what a brilliant costume. So simple, so evocative, so, you know, symbolic.
It's funny you say, because he isn't attractive at all. He's hairy. But when you see him as Sacha Baron Cohen, as he points out, the only difference between Borat and his gay German character and Ali G is just how he cuts his hair and shaves. But he's a good-looking guy in normal. He's like legitimately, he's a good-looking dude. And it's amazing how just letting his hair grow out a little and how creepy he can become. It's a testament to the power of hair to define a character.
And a lot of it comes across in attitude and how you carry yourself.
Yeah.
And you're entirely right, but looking forward to that film. So that pretty much taps out the list I brought.
Actually,
with me.
But I wanted to mention something I noticed yesterday on, there's a site, there's like a quasi YouTube site. I can't remember the name of it, but some guy has basically gone up and posted every Simpsons episode and every Futurama episode. And then somebody else who points out, I am not related to these at all, has created all of simp.com and another is like all of Futurama.com. So you can basically at a whim check out every Futurama and every Simpsons episode. I don't know how long it's going to last, but it was kind of weird last night to just, you know, having them accessible on a whim, basically like YouTube on a high feed of Futurama. In fact, I watched a Futurama episode, even though I had it on DVD, I watched it. What was weird was the Simpsons episode. So they have it all the way up until like right now, every episode on there. And none of them have like the Fox logo or any other bug on there. And I'm not sure how they got the most recent episodes from the past couple of years without the bugs.
Somewhere on the back end.
Yeah. So, but I was like stunned and it stuns me. I can't believe Fox and the others haven't shut it down instantly, because they listed this site on Movie Center News or Movie City News. So anyway, it was kind of weird, and it's kind of weird to see every Simpsons episode available.
Yeah, and there are times when I want to go check something out, and it's not easy to do for free on the web.
Yeah,
you try and think, God, I wish I could watch. You know, Top Gear is a perfect example. Yeah. Something that. It's this BBC show that is occasionally on the Discovery Channel.
Yep. In weird hours and weird times.
Yeah, they never really, it's never consistent. And there were clips of it, sections of it, all over Google Video and YouTube for a while, and then a lot of them went away. But
so you think maybe they God, that's like the greatest advertisement for it. That's what got me into this show, was seeing like when he decided to drive that one car to like somewhere in France or whatever, and you know, I can't remember
the Veyron.
I think it was when he was trying to see if it would be faster to train or drive down thing.
The one I am talking about is when they split the team in two. Clarkson drove the Bugatti Veyron basically from Italy to London, and then the other two guys got in a small plane, so that was plane versus
it's a
car,
similar
so
kind of thing, but it was like a show like that got me into watching the show.
Well, and then BBC kind of was streaming them, but apparently it was only when they were showing new episodes.
Oh.
And then I also heard that it was geographically restricted, so if your IP address wasn't within a BBC broadcasting area,
there's ways to spoof that, though. It's the way that people did it with the ABC
shows. Yeah, I
think
the other problem was it wouldn't support. I was trying to watch it from work, and we don't have Reel loaded at work, and it wanted to do a Reel, and it wasn't easy. And so it's a pain in the butt where, God, I don't really want to go into BitTorrent. I feel better about trying to steal that, because it's not that I steal anything ever. I would never admit to that on a.
So you've been following the story about the dude that got injured.
Oh, that's.
It's awful. And you're not, I don't know what to make of it, because you're hearing like some of the you're hearing the host, I mean the doctor saying, We're fully hoping and expecting or something he'll make a full and happy recovery, yada yada. But then they keep saying he's in critical care in the neurological area.
Well,
and
he's out of critical care. I haven't checked this. Last time I checked was Friday. This is Sunday. Yeah. Basically one of the three presenters of Top Gear, Richard Hammond, was in a 300-mile-per-hour dragster, basically, trying to break the British land speed record,
which is, by the way, huge in Britain. Britain, they're into land speed records over there.
Something went wrong, and the vehicle veered off course and crashed. And so he was airlifted to the Leeds Hospital, or I don't know where, it doesn't matter. Basically, serious brain injury, which just freaks you out. Although, people are saying he was... somewhat communicative when they took him away. So, it's hard to tell because there aren't that many details, and he's out of the ICU and he's still serious, but he's stable. Clarkson said that he and James May, the other two presenters, went and have spoken with him, and Clarkson said he made fun of Hammond's driving, and Hammond laughed. So that's good. And he's taken some steps good. And so you really have to wonder, well, that all sounds great, but serious brain injury?
I know.
And you feel, it sounds like he's okay and that, he's going to live.
Yeah.
Hopefully the essence of himself isn't damaged and he'll be able to function 100%. And you certainly want that. And then I have to feel like a jerk for saying, well, I hope he comes back to the show.
I know.
I feel like a jerk for just,
well, because
I just want him to be happy. Why do I have to want him on the show?
Well, what's funny is I've read a lot of articles. There's a lot of naysayers talking about saying, oh, we're that show. It's driving us nuts because they take all these risks and this was bound to happen. I don't know what to say about that other than near as I can tell, you can't not pin this thing on. This is a very dangerous thing that a lot of people in Britain did. He just happens to be on a show filming it for the show, but I wouldn't. And it seems to me they were taking as many safety precautions as you can when you're strapping yourself to a rocket that goes 300 miles an hour on land. Mm-hmm. So on its face, I don't understand why people are jumping to blame any particular person.
I don't know.
Anything.
It seems like there's an aspect to English society, which you don't see that much, which is the ultra conservative side of it. Usually it's the very funny, Ollie G that comes over or whatever, or The Office. It's this, the other side that comes over and not this sort of repressive environment.
Yeah.
But it's just this unapproving. And one aspect, a Top Gear from last season, the three guys go down to BBC South Counties and they're going to host the afternoon radio drive show.
Yeah.
Which is and Top Gear is like the most popular car show in the world.
Yep.
It's insanely popular.
Yeah.
And it's been around for a while.
Since 1977.
Although with a rotating.
Yeah. It was a totally different show, and Clarkson was part of it. Then he left, and the version we know now has been around since basically 2001.
Anyway, so these three guys go down to do this radio show. Hammond, the guy who was just injured, had radio experience. The other two didn't. And so he's trying to impress upon them the value of preparation and doing a professional job. And what are we going to talk about? Because it's a weird combination of playing music and news and discussion.
Yep.
Sort of a potpourri of every genre you can imagine. And the other two guys have no interest in prep at all.
Yep.
And you always have to wonder how much of that is staged for the benefit of looking funny.
Yeah, my role is going to be the person that doesn't want to have any preparation.
And so they go on the show, and it's a disaster. It is an unqualified disaster. They're missing, I work in radio as one of my 5,000 jobs. And they're missing their cues. There's dead air. They're playing the wrong sound at the wrong time. The mics are messed up.
Which is funny to watch, but painful to listen to.
Oh, man. And meanwhile, they start getting, Clarkson's brilliant traffic idea was that he was granted control of some of the traffic cameras, and he would be able to zoom in on people who would stall, and he would read out their VIN, the vehicle identification numbers, or their license numbers, and mock them on air so people would know exactly who was causing the bottlenecks. Only it didn't work because he couldn't quite get that resolution. And anyway, so the calls start coming in just you know, this is the worst thing I've ever heard. I've been a loyal BBC South Counties listener for 23 years, and this is the most... And clearly, oh, you know, God. These old conservative listeners who just have no idea.
They've never even heard and of you're Top Gear, probably.
It's just unclench.
Yeah.
Just go along, you know, yes, it's a disaster, but it's also funny.
Yeah, and it's not like this is the new show.
And so it's just, it was sort of this weird window into this ultra conservative, yeah. can't take a joke, doesn't understand what's going on aspect. And I think there's a little of that going on of, well, those boys shouldn't be driving fast anyway. Look what happens.
Yeah. yeah.
Just sort of this look down your nose. Bah.
No, I think you're exactly right. And it's, I don't know. I just like, you know, the guy's still in the hospital. You want to be the naysayer. Just why do it now? What's weird is to know it's a BBC show and BBC is the main news source over there. So all these naysayers, all the positive, I'm reading these all on BBC websites, which is a real testament to the BBC's ability to cover itself, which is something that doesn't happen here at all, or rarely at all. But over there, that's the way of operating, because broadcast media mostly is dictated by a public entity, BBC. So it just was kind of weird. And it seemed clear that there was no particular restrictions on the people doing the reporting. So anyway,
any new DVDs this week?
No, actually I didn't have any, although this, the one I'm watching now is from I bought last week, Mommy Dearest, which is the famous movie, came out like in 82 or something, of Faye Dunaway playing Joan Crawford. And it was based on the tell-all book by Joan Crawford's daughter, who just savaged Joan Crawford in this. And the movie got horrible reviews when it came out, and immediately to save money, the producer, the company that put it out, started telling people, no, it's supposed to be campy, and they encouraged drag queens to show up at the thing. And so anyway, the movie has a commentary track by John Waters, the director. Yeah. And he's basically trying to say, his whole point is that people are making this movie out to be camp. It's actually a really good movie, and he's trying to defend it, but in only the way he can defend it, in a way that actually is kind of putting it down. So it's kind of an amusing thing to see how much he likes this movie and him referring to it or whatever. But anyway, so it's got this, what at the time, and in most people say, this wonderfully, unbelievably over the top performance by Joan Crawford, or by Faye Dunaway as Joan Crawford. I actually didn't think it was that bad. The movie feels melodramatic, like it's from the 60s a little bit, but it's not that bad. But anyway, other than that, no other DVDs. I'm just kind of plowing through the ones I have. I was adding it up, and I'm like at 900 or something, 950 now. But I was looking at them and realizing there's like about 70 I haven't seen. So, I mean, literally, if I spend 2 months, 5 hours a day, it would take me that long just to get to the ones I haven't seen.
About that, yeah. And there's, movie-wise, there's not much going on at the moment. I still want to see Hollywood Land.
Yeah.
John saw it, said it was good.
Boy, I've heard great things about Ben Affleck.
I said I was kind of interested in Black Dahlia, but not really. John did not like that at all.
So is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It backs up what the critics say.
Yeah.
So, I mean, occasionally if a critic savage something and then a friend sees and says, yeah, but it's fun anyway. Yeah. Or if you know, this aspect of it is good. He didn't like it at all.
I just heard it was a mess.
Yeah, I did. I think that was essentially what John
said. And it's dropping out of sight. It's like already like 9 in the theaters right now.
Oh, well. So, and October 6th is The Departed. Is that the only, I think that's the only thing in the immediate future.
Borat November or October?
I think November.
Oh, geez. Yeah, there isn't much coming up. Hard to believe.
That's fine. I don't need to take time out of my day and spend all that money.
I definitely been thinking about it's playing locally, like in one theater. I want to go see that Half Nelson. I've heard so many good things about this movie and Ryan Gosling in this movie.
Oh, I know the last thing I wanted to touch on.
What's that?
Listening to another podcast, they had mentioned the new Red camera.
Yeah.
Have you?
No.
Do you know about it at all?
No. What are they talking about?
Oh, wow. Basically, it's like somehow it's related to the Oakley sunglasses company.
Yeah.
Like they're heavy into optics.
Hang on. We're just going to take a break out and watch this incredible play here.
Whoa.
Okay, another guy, he's down though. He got hit hard. We're watching the Cincinnati Pittsburgh game, and he got the wind completely knocked out of him on that. Okay. Ugh.
All right. Well, that was fascinating take a little for break. Our listeners.
So anyway, the Oakley. So it's a camera, like it's a glasses camera or something?
No, it's somehow Oakley or the developers or the owner of Oakley. I'm fuzzy on the actual relationship. Not that it's mysterious. I've forgotten what it was.
Yep.
No, it's a motion picture camera. And basically, it's a digital motion picture camera that captures things in 4K RAW and spits it out in just about any format you want.
Jesus, but what's it? Jesus. So if it's doing this, is this like a $100,000 camera? Is this a
that this is the aspect of it that's so amazing. The essential MSRP is $16,000 or $17,000.
Holy crap. So is it spit out to hard drive?
I'm not sure. I think there's a special cartridge. I don't know if it's tape or hard drive, because if it's hard drive, it takes up, I mean, you need RAID arrays. You need gigantic storage for this thing. Assuming that you take the max output.
Wow.
And it's fine. I mean, it's been talked about for a while, but it's sort of been in the vaporware stage. And apparently it's been demoed now a couple of times at actual conferences in front of professionals, and the professionals are saying, whoa, this is doing what they said it was going to do.
So when Lucas and the others and Rodriguez, they're using their digital cameras, are those at 2K or 4K?
I don't know.
Cause those
I don't
are
know the specs on you know. Those. And so this is finally that what basically they're accepting reservations to make the initial batch of 500.
Yeah.
And they're going to close reservations, and then I think make that batch, make sure they can do it, and then start selling it in larger quantities.
That is really close to consumer level.
And then, so that's the cost of the camera, and then I guess they have two lenses. One's, I think, $10,000, and the other is $16,000, which is certainly expensive, but by way of comparison, the guy was saying the camera we used to film this podcast has a $35,000 lens on it.
Yeah.
And So what's so game-changing about this is, A, 4K capture is insane, and B, that it's affordable.
Yeah.
It really...
Stunningly affordable. And when they say affordable, they mean rentable, basically.
Well, not even that.
You could actually buy it.
If you were a production house, that's well within your budget.
Yeah, I know.
And it's a potentially game-changing camera
because so many of the film cameras in Hollywood... It's actually nobody owns lenses because they're all made by Panavision, and Panavision rents them.
And apparently it looks like they're making their own lenses.
So they're going to break the stranglehold of Panavision and others too.
And I don't know if it can accept foreign lenses. So I don't know if it'll accept Panavision lenses or not.
Yeah.
But it's got this super, like it's the they call it the Mysterium CCD, but that's part of it. And it's just incredible.
You'll have to check it out.
And so the news is that it's now been shown to a couple of conferences, and it's pro, and people are saying that the picture quality is insanely good. Hmm. It's not quite as warm as film, but it's not that it's any worse than film, but it's different, but you can see the quality of the image.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were live demonstrations and not something canned. And so it's just amazing.
Wow. Cool.
And beyond that, it just looks cool. It's like black and it's got this hexagonal frame, and you should check it out when we're
done. Yeah, I'll definitely do that.
And it's part of the whole, you know, the process of making movies and anything filmed is just becoming more and more accessible to everyday people, which is both good and bad. Cause then you got to filter through it. You know, it's part of the larger discussion of there's so much to filter through.
Yeah.
But, you know, as the barriers of entry come down, and especially just the quality of things.
It's funny. The film actual celluloid processing in film houses and the associated things that relate to that are becoming the buggy whip of the modern age, meaning there's not going to be much of a need for it. If everything is pure digital, suddenly it's not being replaced by other expenses. You're just bringing down the cost of stuff and increasing the accessibility.
Although, I don't know. I mean, you say bringing down the cost.
From a printmaking standpoint, ultimately, if and when theaters go digital, from a printmaking standpoint, they spend millions.
Exactly right.
And then in terms of the other, there's certain costs certain, not huge, but depending on the size of the movie, could be huge costs associated with using, although nobody even does anymore, but editing on film, but, or at least making prints, at least getting them developed, converting them digital for editing if you did it that way.
But it'll be interesting to see, it'll be interesting to see what the costs of the storage are. Mm-hmm. And if it's, it's just overall reduced costs doing everything digital. But when you start capturing everything at 4K, your storage requirements suddenly shoot up.
Yep.
And needing to manipulate that much information in real time really does tax your computing power. Yeah. And so I have no idea what is required. How big a RAID array do you need?
Yeah.
How much redundancy do you need? Excuse me. And then how expensive a system do you need to be able to manipulate that stuff in real time? Because that's an enormous amount of information back and forth through your IO pipes.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
You have to think by now there's enough people in the process that understand digital that aren't scared of it, but there's probably enough people that are scared of digital and want to hold on to film because they understand the cost structure.
Yeah.
And you go in front of them and say, this is what a RAID array is going to need, and they freak out and they don't want to change because they're scared.
But there's so many people that clearly are moving that direction. It's that you end up finding the few people like Steven Spielberg and I can't remember what other director.
Yeah, but he's using the art argument.
He's
not saying that there's anything wrong with digital. He's just saying, I prefer for artistic reasons to edit in film.
Yeah.
And so it's not that he's, maybe he is scared of it, but the public reason is he just prefers artistic reasons.
It's interesting because he clearly has the power to do exactly whatever he wants, but it's interesting that other directors, even if they wanted to make that argument, are at the point now that they actually kind of can't. It's practically hard to edit in film.
I know. The other big thing about the RED camera was its ability to capture light information, its f-stop range. Because that is a huge limitation right now for even the expensive digital cameras is they're not, the light information they capture is so limited that it limits what you can do in post. Whereas with film, you can be shooting in crappier light environments and fix
and
a lot optically afterwards.
God, I would think.
Apparently,
they're
saying this has, I think, an 11 stop range, but some people are saying actually up to a 14 stop range.
Wow.
And I know so little about stops actually and exposure settings, that doesn't mean much to me, but apparently that's awesome.
Well, but I thought that was the whole point to video was that it could capture a lot more, but then you introduce green
aspects. It captures dark environments a lot better.
Yeah.
But like shooting in daylight, it's now that this camera can capture a lot more range than the previous generation digitals could. And that is something that cinematographers are very excited about.
Well, I'll definitely have to check it out. It sounds cool.
So that was a little geeky.
Bless you.
Thank you for forcing your religion on me.
With the healing powers of the almighty Satan.
All right. That's just, there you go. Anything else you want to touch on?
Nope.
All right, we should probably wrap up.
Yep.
God, was there any email this week? There might have been an email I was supposed to talk about, but I think that was last week.
Yep.
All right, any questions, comments, concerns, go to youguysrock@mustardayonnaise.com. It's not hard to spell. It's the entire word mustard and half of the word mayonnaise. What we've done is we've combined the two to save time.
Technically, we didn't combine the two. The geniuses at Show.
You're revealing our source.
We got to reveal it somehow. Nobody's ever going to figure it out. Actually, I'm sure somebody typed in mustard mayonnaise in like Google.
It's not that we were ducking it. I just wasn't addressing it. Yeah. I was at one random point going to kind of address it anyway.
We'll address it in further detail on the website if and when I ever get it up.
There is a website.
Well,
it's just not Richard's ideal website. No,
that's true.
All right. You guys rock at mustardayonnaise.com is how you contact us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Nick.
I am Richard.
And we both thank you for listening.
That, thank you.
Booyakasha.